Welcome back to Learning to Lead. We've been talking about leadership and that whole definition. I'll give it to you again because you're going to have to know it by the time you're done with this class. Leadership is the process of a leader encountering culture, the way we do things here, in order to define a preferable future and then provide the impetus for the planning and the programming that is needed to be done to make the future a reality. That's what we're about. Well, we are in the area called leadership, and we've been talking about how you find out you're a leader and what those leadership gifts look like and how you knowing yourself will help you be a leader. We've been talking about that for the past several sessions, and it's my privilege to introduce to you today probably my longest-term friend in history. Frank Weavers has been a friend for over 50 years. We kind of grew up together since middle school, and we ended up going through seminary together, and it's been a time of connecting with each other over the years just to get to know each other and to help each other. And I've come to know him as a tremendous leader. He is a husband, he's a father, he's a grandfather, but he's also been an incredibly effective leader. And so it's my privilege, as I'm trying to bring some practicing leaders into your experience out there, to introduce Frank to you. So, Frank, maybe you can tell us, first of all, just how you have grown as a leader. I mean, growing up, what kind of experiences did you have that would say, guy, I'm going to be a leader someday?
Well, I was born when my dad was a dairy farmer in Wisconsin. So he had an eighth grade education. But he felt a call to ministry. And so when I was 9 months old, so I don't have a lot of farm blood in me, when I was 9 months old, he moved off to go to college, Calvin College, and then on to seminary. So when I was young, I just sort of grew up in a home in which my dad was going to school. My dad was preparing to be a pastor. So, you know, that was sort of my roots. I could have been a farm kid, and I ended up being the son of a pastor. And at an early age, I began to think that God was calling me to be a pastor. And it's kind of an interesting story. Some people have really dramatic stories of how they were called to be a leader in church ministry. But for me, it was the fact that my parents, and my mother especially, bought me a little matching suit. When my dad went out to preach, I had a little suit when I was probably 5 years old. And people would say, oh, you look just like your dad. And my mother would say, and what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say, on cue, well, I'm going to be a pastor someday. And everyone would say, oh, that's wonderful. I actually have a picture, Bruce, of me standing when I'm about 5 years old. I must have been on a chair. I'm standing behind the pulpit with my hands raised in benediction. So at an early age, I began to pray, God, help me someday become a pastor, but don't make me be a missionary. I actually prayed that for years as a kid.
Why not a missionary?
I thought, you know, at the time, my concept of what a missionary was, you went to Africa, you know, when they came back, they would show pictures of huge snakes. I wasn't a snake fan. And I thought, you know, this would be a terrible life to be dragged off by God to some other country. So I just wanted to sort of, I guess, be like Dad. Mm-hmm. Later in life, my mother would introduce me. She was always proud I was a pastor. And she'd say, you know, he became a pastor, and we never even pushed it. And I thought, you know, what home did you grow up in, Mother? But that was my call. I was called into ministry early on, sort of through the manipulations of a mother. God uses all kinds of ways. But then when I was in high school, in fact, Bruce, you and I had this similar experience. We signed up for a summer ministry program. And my dad had been serving large churches in his ministry, churches that were sort of internal. He was a great pastor, but he sort of, all the focus was internal in the church. He worked hard, all those things. But church was sort of boring to me. It was, we never penetrated our neighborhood at all. It was just sort of like a little fortress church. The world's a bad place. We're safe here and as Christians. So you and I both went on a summer ministry program to Ogden, Utah. And there I met a very different kind of pastor leader than my dad. And that was this fiery, red-headed preacher called Gary Hutt. And I stayed in a home where the family that I stayed with for weeks and weeks and weeks, they were new Christians. They were messy. The church was filled with all these variety of people. We're there a day or two and he drops us on the corner and says, talk to people about Jesus. He took us down to the toughest parts of town where there were a lot of alcoholics. People actually passed out in the street and he said, tell them about Jesus. And I came home from that changed, where I said, I want to be a pastor, but I want to be a pastor like that. A church that's focused outward. So that was the original sort of time in my life, I think, when my calling was confirmed. And I started thinking about the options of what kind of leader can a person be when they're a pastor.
So I know that our training was very much to be the chaplain, taking care of people when they're sick, preaching on Sunday, maybe teaching a class here or two of to high school kids or whatever. And when did you figure out that you were called to be a leader within the church?
Well, I think that was a sort of gradual process. I mean, I guess everybody knows that's going to become a pastor that there's going to be some leadership involved in this. But the model I had of my dad was that leadership was sort of focused inward. You preach good sermons. You show up when people are in need. But our leadership had nothing to do with really moving out into the neighborhood. Our church, the churches that I grew up in, really had nothing to do with people that lived one block away from the church building. It was sort of us. So as I entered ministry, I sort of fell into the pattern of my father, I think. In my first church, it was a rural church, and I was run ragged just making sermons, visiting people in times of need. It was a small rural church that really expected the pastor was hired to do about everything. So I was just run ragged. I would be exhausted at the end of a Sunday. And after 4 years in this wonderful church, I just had to go. So I moved from there to a small church in Jacksonville, Florida, sort of a missional church that hadn't gone well. There were about 30 people there. And I learned a lot about leadership there, especially about what not to do, because all the models of my youth just didn't work there. This was a diverse group of people. There wasn't a church of our denomination within about 100 miles. Some of the things I thought, you know, you should just automatically do didn't make any sense there. So I began there to at least start thinking about maybe I should lead in a different way. Maybe I should learn some new skills. But then the third church I went to was really the church where I spent most of my ministry. It was my life calling. I spent 25 years in Holland, Michigan at a church. And it was really there that I bumped into several people that pushed me. One was a young woman in our church who was involved in business. She was an incredible leader, and she kept telling me, Frank, you are not just a preacher. You are a leader. You have to take us somewhere. And so she just shoved all kinds of leadership books my way. And then also at that time, I began attending every year the Willow Creek Conference with Bill Hybels, and he was a great inspiration for me, teaching me that pastors are leaders. So through just a slow process, increasingly I became aware of the fact that the church should be going somewhere. The church is not just a maintenance kind of position. The church is going somewhere. There's always a new place that God wants to bring a church. So I began to increasingly see my role as not only a teacher, but critically as a leader. So I began to read everything I could on leadership. I began to be mentored by some great leaders, and you know, over time, I think I picked up some skills. But I did become aware of the fact that, like it or not, I was called to lead this growing church.
So you get involved with a leadership process, and you interact with the culture there, and things got to change and develop a vision. What were some of the visionary things that came out of your leadership, particularly at the last church or when you were in Jacksonville, either one?
Well, I think I'll comment on my last church because it was really a long process in which the church really was transformed over those years. I learned, first of all, how important structure is. And so I think I led the church through a change in leadership structure. I really kind of inherited the system from the denomination in which I was a part. You know, here's this elder board and a deacon board, and then there's some pastors or a pastor. And I quickly began to see that this church had a very dysfunctional leadership structure. There was a huge church council of elders and deacons, and there were elders meetings, and there were deacons meetings. There was an executive team that met, and it was just chaos. And there was sort of an anti-pastor as a leader mentality as well. One of the lead elders told me, as far as I'm concerned, you shouldn't even be able to vote around here. So when I came there, you know, the pastor was almost the enemy when it came to making decisions, leading us somewhere. So over a process of years, we began to evaluate the structure as the church was growing. We came to the conclusion it wasn't bad people in positions. It was a bad structure, not bad people, but bad structure. And I led them through a process in which we brought in other leaders from churches that had grown, and they talked about how they had to rethink. I didn't push, but I gave them lots of information. Over a process of about a year, we completely restructured the church, which made it possible to get decisions made quickly. Mm-hmm. Capable people were in positions with clear lines of authority. And I can't tell you how much the church changed when we moved toward clear definitions of leadership. The church got rid of that big stamp pad that says no on it. You know, leaders go, nope, we're not going to do that, nope. Mm-hmm. And we were led by staff and governed by elders. So I think changing structure was a critical point for me as a leader in that congregation. And I would say it is one of the two or three things that accounted for the ability to grow as large as we did, which was about 1,400 people. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I know, too, that one of the key things you did was keep vision in front of people, at least in later years, yep. Powerfully. And maybe you can just share some of that, some of the vision that you had, and how did you roll it out to people? How did you keep reminding people? How did you keep people focused on vision? We're going to be talking about that later as far as in the course. We're going to be talking about what it means to write a vision statement, how you develop vision. But if you can just share a little bit about your experience there.
Well, I'll begin by saying that I believe that, in general, churches want to be led somewhere. I mean, church should be an adventure, right? This gathering of people who are passionate disciples of Jesus. This should be an adventure, right? This should be more than about, lawnmowers, which one we're going to buy, what kind of computer we're going to get, what about putting on an addition, all those kinds of things that can be very divisive. So I think that, in general, churches and members of churches are eager to be led in a way in which they say God is taking us somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think in nature, churches that I've experienced tended to be cyclical. So, you know, every year they would kind of go around and round. So it's this time of year, so we do this. And then it's, Advent and we do that. And then it's the summer and we do this. And you just every year try to do it a little better than you did it the year before. But there's just this sense of a church is sort of spinning round and round and round. And I became convinced that churches should at least have a part of their experience being linear. We are going somewhere. And so what I began to do is each year we would kick off our fall season with a focus banquet. And we invested lots of resources in planning this focus banquet. And we invited all adults in the congregation to gather. And so we would say, this is where we believe God is leading us. Now to do that with a clear conscience, you have to be waiting on God. You have to be talking with others. You have to have a pulse of what's happening, your finger on the pulse of what's happening. So months ahead of time, we'd begin praying and planning, and the congregation would gather 400 or 500 people with a sense of excitement. Where is God taking us in the next year? So not just go round and round, but where are we going? And we had all kinds of powerful experiences by doing that. You know, this year we feel that God is calling us to be more fully a house of prayer. Throughout the year, that's what we would focus on over and over again. What does it mean? What changes need to happen to become more fully a church of prayer? We had one year in which we introduced the concept of hitting the streets. We are way too ingrown. We had built a new facility. A lot of focus was internally as a church. We need to move out of this building and hit the streets. So, we sold that kind of vision, and then throughout the year, we gave all kinds of opportunities and training. How do we get out of the building and into the community that God's placed us in? Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most powerful focus event in which we were taken in a new place was what we called the Year of Jubilee. I had gotten away by myself. We had just paid off the debt on our new facility, and we're getting ready to build phase two. And, I felt a little guilty, all the money that we'd spent as a church. I knew one thing we would do at the Focus Banquet, we would burn the mortgage. But I didn't know what else we would do. So I got away for 3 or 4 days, and I stumbled upon that Old Testament concept of Jubilee, you know, this radical, every 50 years, God's people were to do something radical. Land is redistributed. Land is given rest. Slaves are set free. There was a radical generosity. So I thought, what would that look like to declare a year of Jubilee at the church I serve, Calvary Church, in which we would put a pause on the building program, the second phase, and instead of a capital stewardship campaign where we'd raise money for our building, we would say, make a one-year plan, and in that year, we will put up structures all over the world where people can't afford it, but they need a place. So $370,000 was committed to that. We built 7 buildings around the world. I also encouraged every family to have at least one person that would go somewhere in the world where they would see a world in need, a world in poverty. And what happened in that 1 year of Jubilee, God sabotaged us. When the year was done, we said, why have a year of Jubilee when we can be a church of Jubilee? So we tore up the glossy brochures of the phase two. We decided in comparison to so much of the world, we had great facilities, and we began to really radically commit large amounts of our resources. When I left, almost 800 people had gone somewhere in the world in a place of need. We had given away millions of dollars. We had a budget of $1.6 million. We gave $800,000 a year away. That was a huge thing that came out of saying, we're not just going to go round and round in a cyclical fashion, but we're going to be open to where is God challenging us and taking us. And I think that night of the Focus Banquet became the most anticipated evening in the life of the church, because Christians love to have a sense that God is taking them to a new place. So that to me was so important, and that's the heart of leadership. Where does God want to take this group of people? How do we challenge and call them to it? And then in the process, how do we keep reminding them over and over of why we're doing it and why it makes a difference?
Good stuff.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Tell me about sometimes where you thought you had the right idea and it turned out to be a bust. It was a failure. And how you handle failure, because that's part of leadership too. You don't always make the right call every single time.
Right. And I think that a lot of, as I look back on ministry, I think one of the failures that I did was I had a concept that if I was a really nice guy, if I led really well, if I explained really clearly, if I brought, you know, all of us along together, we would be able to change as a church from being a rather ingrown church to a very external missional church affecting our neighborhood and many parts of the world, that I could do that in a way in which everybody would cheer. And it was very painful for me to discover that it was not always possible to bring everybody along. And there were times when I know I disappointed people. People thought we were going in the wrong direction. There were people that felt with our push to be missional engaged, we were ignoring our own people. There was once a time when about 150 people left in mass, when a staffer left. Those were bitter, hard times. And I learned that, try as I could, there are times in which leadership doesn't always take everybody along. And that was very painful for me. You know, those are the most painful memories I had, when I and leaders with good intentions say, God is calling us in this direction, and then there were others that were like, no, we're not going there, and created problems or eventually just left. That was really painful for me.
Yeah. And I know you, like all of us who have been in leadership anywhere, had critics and occasionally would send you a email or a note or a letter or a tome.
Yeah.
How did you handle the whole idea of critics?
Well, I think a couple of things I learned over the years. One is that all criticism hurts, no matter how positive it is. You know, when you're giving criticism, when you're giving criticism to a staff, no matter how nicely you word criticism, all criticism wounds. But there is criticism that deeply wounds unnecessarily. So I try to keep myself open to criticism and not be too deeply wounded by it. I try to find where is the nugget of truth, because often criticism, even if it's someone who's really opposed to you, often there's a kernel of truth in this criticism. Try to find that. But I came to believe I cannot make everybody happy. It's not my job to make everybody happy. And criticism comes with leadership, because you may say, we're going to go right, God is calling us to go right, our church thinks all should go right, and there may be people who want to go left with everything they have. So criticism was hard. It's the worst part of leadership for me, was the kind of criticism. I had people say, my friends call you Hitler. Mm-hmm. I mean, that if that doesn't wound you, there's something wrong with you. And an elderly lady in the church had a big box in her back seat of her car. Someone said, what's that for? She said, that's a coffin for our pastor. Mm-hmm. So, and I was thinking, I'm just a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. Leadership, when you say we're going this direction and people move in that direction together, there are times when people stay behind, and it's very painful. It's very hard for me, mm-hmm. because I don't like conflict. I can't understand anyone that likes it, but it does come at times, and you can be misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Those are the painful things. I will say that, you know, letters that weren't signed, or people that said nasty things, or groups that seemed to gather to attack what was happening, happened mostly in the first 10 years. And as I learned more about leadership, and as the church became more shaped by that leadership, as the church began to move as a body in a missional direction, people either began to embrace it or left. And my last 10 or 15 years, it was just a very different situation. I think you can outlast often critics, and some of your critics can become dear friends. I had the person who told me, if I had my way, you wouldn't be able to vote around here, when I left, hugged me and wept and said, I love you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a tough business being a leader, but you do the best you can, learn from your mistakes, and do not allow criticism to paralyze you, because it is easier to say, I guess I'll just take care of everyone and forget about pushing. Let's just do the round and round.
Let's just keep everybody happy.
That's right. We keep everybody happy, but I think in the long run, biblical leadership brings people to wonderful new places. Mm-hmm. So it's worth doing.
Good. Hey, this has been a treat for me. We've talked about this stuff for a lot of years together already. But being a leader, the themes that Frank has brought out today, comes with a cost. We're going to consider that later in a lecture. It comes with knowing yourself well and knowing where your strengths are, but it comes with the idea that you've got to be and choose to be a leader. And that involves finding out where God was calling you to go and calling you to take an organization or a church, and then leading there with God's strength and with the corporate help of the people. And it's going to take a while. It doesn't all happen immediately unless something supernatural happens. So we're going to continue talking about leadership and begin talking about culture and the way things are done here that will have to change. Frank referred to a couple of those situations as we move on in this class.